Huey, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you, Valerie. Welcome, everybody. This is Judge Newsom sitting this week with my colleague, Judge Lisa Branch. And she and I would like to welcome to our panel today Judge Stan Baker, who is a district court judge on the Southern District of Georgia. Before that was a magistrate judge in that district. Before that was a litigator in private practice. And before that, if Wikipedia is to be believed, he was a ranch hand in Montana. So cross him at your peril. But Judge Baker, thank you so much for being with us today and for helping us with our work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Judge Newsom, for that kind introduction. I sincerely appreciate it.
All right. And to our attorneys, most of you have probably been before us in the past. You know the ground rules. I would ask that you be mindful of your time. It's short, so please dispense with any niceties, factual recitations, procedural histories, and just proceed directly to the most salient points of your argument. We don't have a lighting system, of course, on the telephone, but Valerie, our courtroom deputy, will let you know when you have 2 minutes remaining in your presentation. When she tells you that your time has expired, feel free to finish your thought, but please do wrap it up. If we have questions that take you beyond the appointed time, that's fine. All right, and with that, I will introduce our first case, which is United States of America versus David Delgado. I show that Mr. Bradford here is here for the appellant, and Mr. Gray is here for the United States. Mr. Bradford, you may open, and I see that you've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Very well. Fire away.
This is William Bradford on behalf of Mr. Delgado. May it please the court. There were 3 points raised in the briefs, and I will cut straight to the chase on those points as we see them. The first is the probable cause issue on the search warrant. In this case, I think the government, based on their briefing, is relying on a notion that it is reasonable to conclude that someone would take the fruits of a crime or instrumentalities of a crime and put them at their residence. And the cases that they rely on are indicative of that. They are typically theft cases where an object or an item is stolen. Yes,
Mr. Bradford, this is Judge Baker. And before we get into the specifics of your argument on that, why doesn't the good faith exception control this issue? In other words, can't we just find that even if the search warrant affidavit was deficient in some respect, the officers acted in good faith and reasonable reliance on the warrant when conducting the search of Mr. Delgado's home?
Your Honor, I think that the good faith exception doesn't apply in this case because Deputy Thomas was the author of the affidavit and the warrant, and there were internal problems with those the affidavit and the warrant that I think placed it beyond reasonable reliance. Pointedly, the affidavit speaks in terms of seeking property that is connected to the purchase of a controlled substance. It speaks in terms of the object of the search warrant being used to commit in the future the crime of a possession of a controlled substance. When we get to the warrant, it doesn't speak in terms of items related to the purchase of a controlled substance, but instead it says the items are related to the sale of a controlled substance. And in this case, at the time that he authored the affidavit, Deputy Thomas knew that the two packages, the only two packages that we know of that contained contraband, were being held still by himself, that they were not delivered to the residence, that they were securely in his possession. And I think that is also indicative of him putting the crime of unlawful possession of a controlled substance, a state law crime, which would require actual or constructive possession, when he knows that these drugs will never make it into the possession of Mr. Delgado. So I think because of those problems in the warrant affidavit and the warrant itself and the fact that he authored those I think, puts him in a position where he can't really reasonably rely on his own work product, where the errors are internal to those work products.
Just to be clear, there's, as always in law, there's the rule, the exception to the rule, and then the exceptions to the exception. And there's four exceptions to the good faith requirement. And it appears that you're not relying upon the exceptions of misled by knowingly false information or the magistrate abandoning his judicial role. Those exceptions to the exception, you're not traveling under those, correct?
I think that that's a fair statement. To some degree, I think the magistrate inherently has a problem serving their role correctly when they are given information which is, if not false, misleading, or just simply incorrect. But I think that bears more toward what the exception of reasonable reliance on the author of the affidavit.
Okay, proceed. Thank you.
The search warrant affidavit and the search warrant in the case are strictly reliant on one thing, and that is Deputy Thomas's notion that, or hunch, I would say, that people keep things, fruits of crime, instrumentalities at their residence because it's convenient, it's a safe place, it's a place they have relative privacy. But in this case, that notion breaks down because of the fact that the contraband was kept by the police. And there is nothing in the affidavit.
Can I ask you a question? This is Judge Newsom. So I guess even before we get to good faith, I mean, I guess I'm curious about probable cause itself. And if the standard of probable cause is something like fair probability, why is it that two would-be deliveries of drugs to a named person at that named person's residence, plus the detective's past experience, call it a hunch, why is that in the aggregate not sufficient? I just don't think I understand that.
I think it's because that is the only thing that it's reliant on. There, and the court has seen many affidavits of officers as well as counsel. There's no confidential informant making a purchase in the past. There's no word on the street related in the affidavit or a confidential informant providing information. There's no observations by officers. No one anywhere in the affidavit does it say that anyone ever saw any illegal activity or any contraband at the residence. The only thing that it says is that we believe there may be documentation, not even the fruits or instrumentalities, but just mere evidence in the form of some document to support the fact that he is the one that ordered it. The affidavit itself says, it's my belief that David Delgado or some other unknown person who has a connection to the address. So even in the affidavit, Thomas is not completely confident that it is Mr. Delgado. And I think it's relying on basically, I don't want to call it a presumption, but I think just a notion that that this is where things are normally kept. In this case, this was
counsel,
a product.
This is Lisa Branch. Let me ask you a question. If the police had executed, to Kevin's point, to Judge Newsom's point about probable cause, if the police had executed a controlled delivery instead, would you still have an objection to probable cause?
I don't think that I would, because I think at that point it would be really in the nature of an anticipatory search warrant in a way. And they would have knowledge that the actual contraband would be there. In this case, they knew for a fact that it would not be there. And
but
I think
surely you're not requiring that in all circumstances. Here we have two packages that have tested positive for a controlled substance, both addressed to your client, going to that address, coming from an address in China that the agents had experience with. Surely you're not requiring in all circumstances that the police execute a controlled delivery, are you?
I don't think that I can require that. I think in this case, the nature of him ordering it off the internet is instructive, though, because it opens up the possibility the order could have been done on another computer, an office computer, a cell phone, or a computer at his home, and would not necessarily generate a paper document. it may be in a computer, it may be stored on a cloud. The ability to rely on the fact that there would be a piece of paper at his home, I think, is undermined by the nature of the purchase and it being an internet sale to begin with. The other thing I'd point out is the Homeland Security Officer Hoffman and Thomas both testified that they had participated in numerous types of mail delivery schemes. And Hoffman said that he had seen this address over 50 times, but no one said they had ever seen Mr. Delgado's name or address associated other than these two packages. So there wasn't a track record of him being on their radar or the address being on their radar. And so there wasn't a notion that maybe there were prior purchases that would be found, some other paperwork from a prior purchase. You're strictly dealing with, we're looking for a receipt, which may or may not exist, that would be at his home, but we don't know if he made the purchase at the home. We don't know if he's the one that made the purchase to begin with. So I think that is a very thin amount of probable cause, and in a case, in this case, our position is it's not enough. I would like to address
counsel. This is Lisa Branch. Let me ask you just one question. We're the only thing that your client is challenging here today is the search of the home and the silencers, correct?
There are some issues about sentencing, but as far as the warrant, that's
correct. But you're not, your client has abandoned any challenge to the controlled substance conviction, correct?
Below
you moved to suppress the information and the drugs in the packages in your client's statements. You are not challenging those anymore, correct?
Not challenging the count that he pled on, no, ma'am.
Okay.
The other point I'd like to make is on the relevant conduct and sentencing. This circuit is one of only of a couple that has not definitively said that relevant conduct must be criminal conduct, and I think that becomes a problem in this case. The sentencing was driven in part by adding calculation to the offense level based upon the weight of the drugs in the first package in count one. Count one was dismissed. And I think the government had to show at sentencing, in order for it to be relevant conduct, that the conduct was criminal. And in this case, because at the time it was purchased and delivered, it was merely an analog, under McFadden, I think the government would have to show that Mr. Delgado had knowledge of the illegality of the substance. And all evidence points to the fact that he didn't.
Mr. Bradford, this is Judge Baker, and I know our time is short. I'm sorry to cut you off, but there's one issue that I'm not sure was sufficiently covered in your brief that I want to get to. Why doesn't United States v. Keene control? You know, the district court says essentially it would have imposed, or not just essentially, it did say it would have imposed the same range of sentence independent of the dispute guideline calculation. So why doesn't Keene just control? Because I don't see an argument in your brief that the sentence was substantively unreasonable.
On Keene, this is what I would respond. Keene is a problem in a way, but I think in this case, when we look at how drastically the guideline numbers would change if the objections were upheld.
The argument has expired.
You can finish up.
I think it's the drastic nature of the change in the guidelines. It's one thing to say that we would have ended up at 36 months if the numbers had only changed slightly. In this case, depending on how the court holds, it could change drastically based upon including the relevant conduct from the first count.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bradford, you've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Scott Gray speaking on behalf of the United States of America. May it please the court. In this appeal, the court must decide whether officers had a lawful basis to enter Delgado's residence and whether his 36-month sentence is reasonable. This court should affirm. Turning first to the conviction, it appears to now be clear that Delgado is not challenging the controlled substance conviction. He's only challenging the searches to the firearm conviction. The search, as the district court found, Judge Grenade handled the suppression motion, and her analysis essentially proceeded in four steps. One, there were two lawful extended border searches of the packages. Second, officers obtained a search warrant for documents related to those shipments and had probable cause to obtain that warrant. Third, officers lawfully could search the safe for evidence of the documents. And fourth, the firearm silencers were in plain view once officers looked for documents inside the safe. To be clear, Ms. Delgado has only challenged the second step in that chain of analyses, namely whether the officers had a lawful basis to be in the home pursuant to the search warrant. The search warrant was both valid because it was supported by probable cause, and alternatively, the officers acted in good faith. First, turning to the probable cause standard, as the court noted, the standard for probable cause is deferential. There has to be a fair probability that contraband or evidence of a crime will be inside the residence. And the affidavit should connect the defendant to the residence and the residence to criminal activity. This analysis is ultimately governed by a common sense approach. The search warrant affidavit met this standard because it linked the residence to criminal activity, it linked Delgado to the residence, and it identified what officers expected to find based upon their training and experience. With the two packages sent in rapid succession, I think the affidavit indicated roughly a 10-day gap. I think the testimony at the suppression hearing was roughly 5 days, but essentially a relatively quick succession. It was reasonable for the officers to conclude that this was consistent with the source of supply and that they had a reasonable basis to believe that documents and information related to these shipments would be found inside the residence. Even if the court disagreed with that, as we noted in our brief, the good faith exception would have applied here because the officers conducted a careful discussion among themselves, and the suppression transcript ultimately reflects that they discussed the matter and decided that a controlled delivery would be difficult here given the nature of the house. I believe there was a locked gate and other features that would have made it difficult to consummate the controlled delivery. And therefore, they had a reasonable discussion and ultimately conducted a reasonable search based on their reliance of the warrant. As I believe Judge Baker noted, there are four, essentially, exceptions to the good faith principle. And I would note, as a threshold matter, that the good faith analysis is broad precisely because the expectation is that law enforcement officers who obtain warrants can then reasonably rely on those warrants as they carry out their law enforcement duties. And therefore, the exceptions are relatively exacting. Misleading information, the magistrate wholly abandoned his judicial role. It was so lacking in indicia of probable cause that it rendered official belief in the existence of the warrant entirely unreasonable, or the warrant was otherwise facially deficient. None of those premises are present in this case. Here, the warrant certainly provided sufficient indicia of probable cause that an officer could reasonably believe that the warrant was valid. They could execute that warrant, and then they could also seize contraband in plain view as they executed that warrant. And again, Delgado hasn't challenged any of the other aspects of the search in this case.
This is Judge Baker. In his argument in response to my question, Mr. Bradford pointed out that Deputy Thomas was not only the affiant, but also was involved in the execution of the warrant, I believe. Does that matter in our good faith analysis?
I don't think it would matter here because I think the record suggests that Deputy Thomas acts in good faith throughout. He supports the warrant on the basis of his professional experience in these sorts of interdictions, his expectations and what he expects to find. And it's also important to note he conducted an independent investigation here. As I read the affidavit, it essentially proceeds in three steps. The first step addresses the extended border searches, which revealed the contraband. The second was Deputy Thomas's own investigation into the residence to confirm both that, number one, it was a legitimate residence. It wasn't some sort of a residence that didn't actually exist. And then second, to find multiple aspects of record that tied Delgado to that residence. So I think here, ultimately, the officer's conduct was reasonable throughout, and that ultimately is why the good faith exception should apply here. His conviction should stand on that basis, and unless the court has further questions on the warrant, I would turn to the sentence. Okay.
Counsel, let me ask you one question about the warrant. So I'm looking at the face of the warrant right now. Is it any problem that it says, toward the end of the warrant, it says, it is my belief that David Delgado or some other unknown person who has a connection with the address ordered both parcels and had them shipped there? Is there any concern that even though the packages were addressed to Mr. Delgado, that it is the warrant leaves open the possibility of some other person having been the person who ordered the drugs?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. I think even if we accept that Deputy Thomas is hedging slightly and that this could be another person with a connection to the residence using Delgado's name, there is a strong connection of this residence to criminal activity, namely the importation or shipment of multiple packages of controlled substances in rapid succession into the United States of America. It certainly is true that not every single package addressed to every single residence would always give rise to a basis for a warrant. But probable cause is ultimately a fact-intensive inquiry that turns on the facts and circumstances of each case, with a heavy dose of deference to the nature of the law enforcement investigation and the officer's experience. And what I read Deputy Thomas to be saying from a common sense point of view is that the two packages are clearly connected to the residence. They're both addressed there. Delgado is clearly connected to the residence. There are multiple items of evidence that suggest that he owns the residence and is the sole owner, and that certainly Delgado or someone connected to him ordered these parcels and had them shipped there. And then in his experience as a law enforcement officer, there are commonly items related to the shipments. And I would note also, just as a brief clarification, of course, the affidavit is in the record twice in this case. It's both as an exhibit to one of the defendant's replies that they subsequently amended, document number 26. It's also defendant's exhibit number one from the suppression hearing, the only distinction being, from what I saw, that the document filed at the hearing included a subsequent state court file stamp on it when it was submitted in the state court records in July of 2017.
Counsel, you said multiple packages arriving from abroad in rapid succession. There were two packages in this case. What if there had only been one package that had been seized by agents? And would that have been enough to support a warrant, a search warrant of the home?
So, Your Honor, I think that's a very close call, and let me explain why. It may have still been enough here because there were very strong indicators that this defendant was the owner of this residence, and the shipping of the package was so clear. I would suggest that you would possibly have to inject another ambiguity into here. For example, it's addressed to the residence, but the name on the package doesn't correspond with an owner or someone connected to the residence, or that there's a name or an owner, but it's connected to a residence in which they don't live. And if you then injected those multiple ambiguities into the situation, I think you would lack probable cause. I would say that you would have enough to nudge it across the line with one package here, but it would be a very close call. But with two, in the circumstances in which they were shipped, and given the nature of the investigation, there certainly was enough to nudge this across the line of there being a fair probability that evidence of this criminal activity would be found inside the residence. Turning to the sentencing issues, the first question here is the Keene analysis, which I believe Judge Baker asked about, and which Delgado I don't believe addressed in his brief. Ultimately, what Keene says is that if the district court indicates that it would have imposed the same sentence regardless, then the any error is assumed to be harmless. Now, there is a suggestion that the variance here would have been too severe, but that simply isn't the case. Number one, it's not even entirely clear what the variance would have been because the probation officer indicated in the sentencing record that if the firearm guideline had applied instead of the drug guidelines, then the ultimate sentencing range would have been essentially the same. But moreover, even if you accept at face value that Delgado could have gotten the sentencing range down to the lowest possible range of the guidelines, which would have been a 0 to 6 month sentence, the 36-month sentence here was still reasonable for the reasons that the district court explained when it ultimately imposed the sentence, namely that Delgado had shown a disregard for the law, that he had another illegal substance called kratom that was found inside the residence, and simply that his conduct in having these products shipped from across international boundaries into the United States and having them handled by different employees who had to get these transactions from point A to point B put people at risk. Moreover, even if the court looks past the Keene statement or found that the Keene statement was ambiguous, the district court properly applied the sentencing analysis in this case. First, turning to the relevant conduct issue, it's not entirely clear that the guidelines only intend to include criminal conduct. Both the definition of relevant conduct and the commentary applying that explain that it's broad. The comments explain that the principles and limits of sentencing accountability under this guideline are not always the same as the principles and limits of criminal liability. Similarly, the definition of controlled substances and analogs in the drug guideline in Section 2D1.1 are similarly broad. Ultimately, though, the court doesn't have to reach that question, that ultimate question, because even if it gives Delgado the benefit of the doubt, the United States still made a McFadden showing for purposes of sentencing. Even if the court applies the McFadden standard of knowledge, which essentially is twofold for purposes of analogs. Number one, knowledge can be established through evidence that the defendant knew he was dealing with a controlled substance, even if he did not know its identity. Or two, the defendant knew the specific analog he was dealing with, even if he did not know its legal analysis as an analog. The court still would have to adapt that standard to the relatively lower threshold that applies for purposes of sentencing. And even in McFadden, the court made clear in footnotes 1 and 3, I believe, that knowledge...
Just a minute, Ronnie.
Thank you so much. The McFadden court made clear that knowledge is not just shown by direct evidence. Knowledge can be shown by circumstantial evidence. And here there's a strong showing of circumstantial evidence regarding Delgado's knowledge. Number one, there were multiple shipments of these substances, including one that he acknowledges was a controlled substance. And the district court found that that was consistent with Delgado attempting to establish a source of supply. Deputy Thomas testified at the sentencing hearing that Delgado referred to the powders as research chemicals and admitted that he took them to help him sleep and used them as a substitute for a prescribed drug, which strongly suggests that he was aware of what these powders were. Delgado also testified at the sentencing hearing and attempted to offer his own innocent explanation for these powders, and the district court found that his testimony was not credible. This testimony supports his consciousness of guilt. Therefore,
Gray, this is Judge Baker, and I understand the arguments you're making. You laid those out in detail in your brief, but one thing about your Keene argument that I was wondering, the sentencing judge here, Judge Moore, did not specifically state, you know, that the exact sentence would have been the same regardless of the guidelines, and typically when a district judge makes a Keene statement, it's during the pronouncement of the sentence. Rather, here, the language you rely upon in your brief was before the lawyers made arguments about the 3553A factors. It was right after the guideline determinations were made. And I also don't see where a statement of reasons was filed. Oftentimes, the statement of reasons is filed by the district court. So does that matter? I mean, where it was pronounced and that there's not a statement of reasons, does that matter? And I'm apologize if I've taken up too much of the time, Judge Newsom.
No, it's fine.
No, Your Honor, and I, by my count, my time has either expired or is close to expire. May I respond to Your Honor's question?
Please answer Judge Baker's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the response here is that certainly this Keene statement is different from the ordinary statement in that it is made before that time. But I think the statement read as a whole is an indication from the court that it is going to be guided by the Section 3553A factors. The court indicates essentially this is the range of sentences that I think would be appropriate, even if the guidelines did not apply, and then asked the parties and the defendant to provide guidance on where the sentence should fall, and the court ultimately sentenced at the low end of that range. I don't recall whether a statement of reasons was filed in the record or not, but I would suggest still that that doesn't ultimately render the sentence unreasonable, and in addition, the sentence would have been appropriate even under the guidelines calculations if the court considers them anew. With that, if there are no further questions, I respectfully would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford. You've got 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would start by saying I think that the question about the statement in the affidavit about some unknown person, I think it does matter. And I think what I have seen in other cases, sometimes addresses are used as a mail drop. Something is delivered, and then the package and everything with it is taken away from the address. So I don't think – and that's fairly common in narcotics world. And I think we can't assume that simply because it was addressed to Mr. Delgado's home that it would be there, or that that's where it would ultimately stay, or that there would be any evidence of the contraband or delivery. In this case, there is absolutely no evidence that any contraband was ever delivered to Mr. Delgado prior to this. And I think that's instructed by the fact that this address for the sender had been monitored for a very long time by Homeland Security. They had identified over 50 packages originating from that address, but none of them apparently until this time had been addressed to Mr. Delgado. So I think it's not fair to say that there was some track record of him receiving packages. We are strictly dealing with two packages in the span of a couple of weeks, packages that were not delivered. And I think that that makes a difference because, Deputy Thomas is making an assumption that because it's addressed to his house, that it would be him and that it would still be there. And I don't think that those are as potent as they seem in this affidavit. As far as good faith, here's I think the bottom line on good faith for us is this. The particularity of the warrant matters under Groh versus Ramirez, and Thomas wrote this affidavit, but he wrote it sloppily. And in the affidavit, he talks about evidence of the purchase of controlled substances. In the warrant, it says it's looking for evidence of the sale. There was never evidence of any sale, ever. There was absolutely no evidence anywhere in the case of a sale. Thomas knew that. Thomas said that on the stand. He said that his belief that Delgado was purchasing these for his own personal use. So, I think that those would count as a defect in the particularity of the warrant, if nothing else, that he should not be able to rely on. Frankly, that the wording of the affidavit and the warrant are all over the place. I mean, and it's far too general for him to come in and say, one, I'm looking for purchase information, and now I'm looking for sale information, and now I'm looking for as grounds that I'm looking for information that would be used in the future to commit some crime. And none of those are the case here. What he is attempting to do is to serve a search warrant for mere evidence, legal documentation that otherwise does not show a crime, but not merely as evidence of some other act that may be a crime. And I think that's the difference. And I don't think he can rely on good faith because he is the author of the affidavit. On Keene, I would say this, that as the factors relied on by the district court are eliminated in some way or undercut in some way, the more that happens, the further we get from a level of confidence that the district court's statement that the same sentence would be given regardless of the guidelines, that starts to fall away. And I think in this case, if there were no search warrant, if the court found that there was no probable cause, that the variance downward to 36 months would end up being an upward departure because we would be looking at 1.27 kilograms of marijuana equivalent, which would be an offense level of 6, which is 0 to 6 months. So the court would have to actually go up to 36 months as opposed to varying downward. And I think that's such a drastic change that it undercuts a statement that this is where we would have arrived at regardless of all these factors. And the more the factors fade away, the more the confidence that that would be the appropriate sentence fades away. And I believe my time is up.
Okay, Mr. Bradford, Mr. Gray, thank you very much. Appreciate the fine argument on both sides. That case is submitted, and we'll